So yeah, as an academic who works in the academic complex, I go to academic conferences often, and that's a normal part of my job. But when I say thank you, and you know, it's kind of customary to say thanks to the people that are there. But this time I mean it extra. I feel like, thank you for inviting me, Alex. It feels like a real honor actually to be part of this weekend's events with you all. And thanks, Chris, Elle, Sherry, who's not here, Alexis, Andrea, Ardith, and in advance, Isaac, for all of the, I've just been getting so much out of the conversations as I've been listening to them so far. Which also means that I've been making lots of notes and making a real mess of my own presentation as I've been thinking of things people have been prompting. So let's see. I wanted to say something about historical narrative and the kind of importance of that, how we remember the 20th century, in really broad terms, as you'll see. And let's hope that still makes some sense. So let me start with a provocation then, that the story that we tell about the 20th century has implications for how we understand the present conjuncture. And for the most part, the story that we hear, and sometimes the story that we tell, gets at least as much wrong as it does right. So just to try, I mean, this is kind of a ridiculous exercise, but let me try to encapsulate the 20th century in a couple of sentences, two different narratives. So the first one that will sound familiar if you put yourself maybe back in high school, or for those who are not in high school yet, there's some younger people here, maybe some foreshadowing. So the 20th century, how does it begin? The European alliance system, the arms race, ethnic nationalism, sparks off the powder keg, begins World War I, followed by the Punitive Treaty, the rise of fascism and Japanese militarism to World War II. The victory over fascism significantly weakens the ideologies of white supremacy and racial segregation as the world becomes divided into the camps of the Cold War struggle between Soviet-led communism and US-led capitalism. And the US, of course, ultimately wins the Cold War, which ushers in the current era, which defined, I guess depending on your political perspective, by free trade or globalization or neoliberalism. And notice the prominence of World War II and the Cold War in that telling. Think about a different narrative of the 20th century, which says that the through line of the 20th century is the dialectic of empire and decolonization, in which the rivalry between the European and US empires, as well as the resistance to them from colonized people, is what led to World War I, which broke the back of the imperial system and accelerated the process of formally dismantling the world's major empires. And the mid-century effort, the word was originally struggle, I'm trying out this new language, the mid-century effort against fascism, which thwarted the attempt by Germany and Japan really to join the Empire Club, interrupted in some ways this process of decolonization, but it renewed resumed with renewed intensity after 1945. And since then, the imperial system, which is constituted along axes of class, race, gender, ability, culture, and sexuality, but is not determined by any single one of them, has survived the challenges of formal decolonization. And the end of the Cold War had the kind of contradictory effect of the exit of the undemocratic Soviet Union while also reinvigorating imperialist domination around the globe. So the lessons we learn then about the 20th century follow from, again, the story that we tell. We could draw different lessons from one of those, from either of those two narratives about what the 20th century was. And even if we already see issues of colonialism as important, those narratives that leave it out, I think, still can have an impact on the way that we think. So I'm working right now on this book called The Anti-Colonial Front, which looks at this loosely allied network of mid-20th century activists and intellectuals from the African American freedom struggle and struggles for national liberation. And part of this for me came out of, so I'm from Vancouver, and I, after years of working shitty warehouse jobs and whatnot, returned to university and encountered through a connection there someone named Jack O'Dell, who lives in Vancouver, and I was fortunate enough to have him as a mentor, someone very influential on my thinking. And he taught me, probably more than anyone, the lesson that we've been hearing a lot about over the last couple of days, that the connection between knowledge production and social struggle. And so part of, as I was saying, I was making notes and changing things as I was listening to the conversation. Even as I was walking home last night, I was thinking, I actually have to go to my office tomorrow morning and get and bring this book to just sort of really emphasize this point. A collection of Mr. O'Dell's essays have come out. And Let me just read, I was flipping through this morning, and let me just give a sense again to show that this project that I'm working on is me trying to follow a story, but it's one of the insights of other people from these earlier generations. So this is from an essay from Jack O'Dell called Foundations of Racism in American Life, and it's from 1964. Let me just double get the date right on this. Just a second. Yes, 1964. And I should say just a little bit about Jack O'Dell. He was probably most famously one of the key advisors to Martin Luther King Jr. He also was the foreign policy advisor for Jesse Jackson during the Rainbow Coalition in the 80s, and was part of many other social movements, and still is still going. He's going to be speaking at a conference in New York in about a month called Confronting Racial Capitalism. He's 92, he's still very much active. Listen to this. This is part of his analysis of racism in the US. Afro-American slavery, the decimation of the indigenous Indian population, their deprivation and confinement in concentration camp reservations, the military conquest of a large part of the national territory of the Mexican people and their dispossession from ownership of the land, the overthrow of Reconstruction's noble effort at representative government and the nullification of the constitutional amendments, the establishment of the state system of racial segregation enforced by police power and lynch mob, the systematic cultivation of white racial supremacy theories of government by the leading educational institutions of the nation, and the application of these theories in the wholesale disenfranchisement of the black population in the southern states, as well as in the conquest of the Philippines, Puerto Rico, and Guam. This was the main path by which the American power structure ascended to the position of a world power by the turn of the 20th century. The state system of racism in America historically served a functional role in the educational development, in the economic development of this nation that was similar in all respects to the role of colonialism in the development of Western Europe. I mean, I don't know who else was writing in this kind of capacious way about all of these different things linked together as early as 1964. So this is just one of many very insightful quotations I could pull out of this collection of essays. So after you finish reading all of those books, get this one and check it out as well. So I say this, and I bring this forward again just to emphasize what my own intellectual debts are on this. And then I was also lucky enough from there to go to graduate school just down the road from where a few folks here, I think, were studying. I went to UC Santa Barbara, and there I also was very lucky to be mentored there by people who continue to teach this lesson to show where these ideas came from and how they were so important in terms of knowledge production. So let me just say just a tiny bit about the project that I'm working on. Then it's to follow this kind of conversation over this series of events, starting after World War II, when again I'm trying to make the point or trying to follow the point that the contest between the kind of larger forces of imperialism and anti-imperialism really. Rather than this be sort of the beginning of an era of world history, the Cold War, it actually is the resumption of an ongoing contest between empire and its adversaries. And so people in this conversation are people like many from the African American freedom struggle, people like W.E.B. Du Bois, well-known figures Paul Robeson, and also outside of the United States, people like the first president of Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah, and other lesser-known figures such as Esther Cooper Jackson, or again, Jack O'Dell was very much part of this broad conversation. And this anti-colonial front against gendered racial capitalism put the question of empire at the center of the politics of the 20th century. And therefore, I think we can learn so much from this. And so some of the points, some of the moments, there's a few important conferences. There's a Pan-African Conference, Congress as it was called, in Manchester, England, 1945. There was a group called the Southern Negro Youth Congress in 1946. They have a meeting in Columbia, South Carolina, where a young Jack O'Dell, Dr. Du Bois, and others are there. There are a number of publications through this era, the NAACP's The Crisis, the Communist Party's Political Affairs, which has analyses, again, theorizing imperialism. People like Claudia Jones, one of the main writers in Political Affairs, theorizing imperialism in the late 1940s and early 1950s as comprised, again, of what we now would call intersectionality, the way in which the interlocking systems make up the broader kind of set of systems against which freedom struggles are find themselves arrayed against. And a few other moments, an important conference happens in Indonesia in 1955 in the city of Bandung. In Paris, there's another important meeting that brings together, in 1956, that brings together people like Frantz Fanon, who's coming out of the struggles in Northern Africa, in Algeria in particular, and bringing those together with African-American and other radical thinkers. And finally, in 1957, with the independence of Ghana, a major achievement in national liberation struggles, quickly followed by the onset of neocolonialism, this issue is continuing through this era. And so my point is a historical point, but hopefully it's of interest, is that, again, this is an era that usually, in terms of world politics, we think it's the Cold War. This is what dominates. This is what comprises what's happening in this era. And actually, this is an era where the politics of the Cold War are not able to silence this other, to my view, more fundamental conversation about imperialism. So, recalling this anti-colonial front and its many insights, again, I would say presents some lessons for us now. First, by curbing the tendency to overstate the importance of Europe to the 20th century world. Notice in those two narratives I started with how much Europe was at the center of it, and less so in the other one. By keeping our eye on capitalism as a generator of inequality while not reducing other structures of inequality to it. By conveying a sense that, again, the Cold War didn't come after an era of imperial rivalry, but was itself primarily a contest between empires. And finally, by more clearly enabling us to see how the intersecting elements of imperialism in all their complexity comprise the principal barrier between the world we live in and the one we might imagine and build together. Thanks. Thank you.